The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 10-1105, State of Ohio versus Gregory Osi. For the appellant, Mr. Lowe. Pardon me?
It's Bruce Smithers.
Oh. For the appellant, Ms. Pamela Prude Smithers. I'm sorry, I had you, Mr. Lowe, as the...
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
I would like to focus today on Osi's first proposition of law that he was denied the right of allocution. Because Osi was denied the right of allocution, we are asking this court to remand his case to the trial court for resentencing. This court has consistently made it clear that trial courts are to painstakingly adhere to the requirements of Criminal Rule 32. The mandatory language of Criminal Rule 32 is clear. It provides that at the time of the sentencing, the trial court shall do the following. It shall afford counsel an opportunity to speak on behalf of the defendant, and it shall afford the defendant an opportunity to speak and make a statement on his behalf or offer additional mitigation evidence. The court addressed Criminal Rule 32 13 years ago in both State versus Green and State versus Campbell. And in those cases, the court found that the right of allocution is to occur during the actual sentencing hearing. The penalty phase in the capital case is not a substitute for the right of allocution. And this court found that the failure to provide such could result in reversible error. Now, the state argues that OC was provided the right of allocution because if you look at the transcript during the mitigation phase, there was a time where the trial court asked Mr. OC whether he wants to allocute. This occurred during the mitigation hearing, not the sentencing hearing, and a review of the transcript seems to indicate that there was some confusion between the right of allocution and the right to make an unsworn statement under the Ohio Revised Code.
Counsel, are you suggesting that he needed to be asked specifically if he wanted to exercise the right to allocution, or that it was insufficient for the court to ask if he wanted to say anything? Is that, are we talking that technical concept of allocution that you're emphasizing?
Yes, it is the right of allocution under Criminal Rule 32. And what I'm saying is that here it should have occurred at the time of sentencing. During the sentencing hearing, the trial court brought the parties in after the deliberations. They went over the aggravating circumstances, went over the mitigating circumstances, weighed those, and then sentenced Mr. Osi to death. They didn't ask the counsel whether they had to say anything on Mr. Osi's behalf. They didn't ask Osi whether he had to say anything on his own behalf.
Was there any request for that right?
No, but pursuant to this court's case law in both Green and Campbell, it's the trial court's obligations to ask those things.
And what weight, if any, should we give to the fact that Mr. Osi made no statement voluntarily unsworn during the mitigation phase?
I don't think any weight should be given to that. If you look at this court's case law in both Green and in Campbell, those defendants did not make unsworn statements either. Though that's a separate issue. An unsworn statement that you can make is during the mitigation hearing,
okay.
And that is separate and apart from the right of allocution, which is to occur at the sentencing phase.
And then if we remand this pursuant to your argument, it goes back for what?
For resentencing on that, and at that point, the trial court would be obligated to ask Mr. Osi whether he
is that a reweighing again then?
Well, I think at that point the trial court would have to consider, and if you look at this court's opinion in State versus Roberts, which just came out in October of last year.
I think we're familiar with that.
That's what this court required the trial court to do there. It asked the trial court to resentence Ms. Roberts, and at the time to provide her with the right of allocution. The problem that they ran into there was the trial court did not consider the statements that she made in the allocution. So I think that, yeah, part of the reweighing.
So you want us to follow what has been done in Roberts and have the three-judge panel reconvene?
Yes. Ask for the sentencing, resentence, ask Mr. Osi whether he has anything to say on his behalf, ask defense counsel whether they have anything to say on Mr. Osi's behalf.
Would it be the same three judges in your view, or could it be other judges?
I believe it should be the same three judges. I'm not certain on that point.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
But the question would be, what if one of the judges is not available? Then what do we do? Mm-hmm. You're not asking for an entirely new trial, are you?
No, I don't believe under the right of allocution he has a right to have a whole new trial or a whole new sentencing hearing. I believe it's just he is to be sent back to be resentenced.
Counsel, I understand the right of allocution. I understand this court has been very clear about this. But is it your position that the right of allocution, if it is omitted, does not require a showing of prejudice? And the reason I ask that is because the judges heard the case and they heard from the defendant, albeit in a different proceeding. Do you have to show prejudice?
Well, if you look at the court's rulings in Green and Campbell, they said that it could be harmless. Back in the State versus Reynolds, this court also said it could be harmless.
That's my question.
They actually found that it was harmless because Reynolds had made an unsworn statement during the mitigation hearing. Reynolds sent a letter to the court speaking on his own behalf. So the court found it was harmless there because they were able to consider from the defendant's own words some of the evidence that he could have presented. That did not happen here. And if you look at Green, which occurred in front of the three-judge panel, that didn't happen there. And in that case, this court did not find that it was harmless. Now, I think it's pretty clear from the record that during the sentencing phase, the first sentencing hearing, there was no right to allocution provided. But at a point about a week after the sentencing hearing, there was a second sentencing hearing. And at that point, the court brought Mr. Osi back to the trial court to correct a post-release control sentencing error. The state has argued that even if there was not a right of allocution provided during the first sentencing hearing, at that second sentencing hearing, when the trial court asked whether Osi had anything to say, that was sufficient to provide the right of allocution.
Did he say anything at that sentencing hearing?
Mr. Osi did not say anything at that sentencing hearing.
So there's a possibility that if we were to remand for the right to allocution, he again could decline to say anything, as he did in declining to say anything at mitigation and declining to say anything when he was sentenced.
That is correct. He could make a decision not to say anything. But I believe under this court's case law, if you look at, once again, Green, Campbell, and Roberts, the court said that there has to be painstaking adherence to the right of allocution by the trial courts, and that is what did not occur here. And it can't be an ambiguous request to speak on the capital counts. It has to be a specific request to speak on the capital counts. That did not occur here. The second sentencing was just on the post-control release issue. The trial court told OC that part of his sentence was voided, and that was the part that went to the post-control release. The court then asked OC whether they had anything to say, and they resentenced him on all counts. As I said, although OC was provided the opportunity to speak, the court's inquiry was directed only towards the non-capital counts. And if you look at this court's case law in Singleton and Ohio Revised Code 2929-191, the second hearing on the post-control release error could only be on that specific non-capital count. It was not a de novo hearing. It could not be a de novo hearing.
So what do the judges have to say to the defendant, in your view, to have this not be a problem?
Would you like to say anything on your behalf before you are sentenced on your aggravated murder count? It's a very, you know, simple
They don't have to use the word allocution, in your view.
No, I don't believe they have to use the word allocution. And in fact, I think that's confusing probably to capital defendants. I don't think a lot of people know what allocution means. I think just simply asking whether he has anything to say. That's what the statute says, asking whether you have anything to say before you're sentenced.
But that's what he was asked at the sentence. The resentencing. I understand your argument about post-release control, that it
right.
was only for that purpose.
Right.
But he wasn't told, you may only talk now about post-release control. The judges said, do you have anything to say, correct?
That's correct.
Now you want us to send it back again to say, do you have anything to say?
On his aggravated murder count. And if you look at this court's holding in State versus Green, a similar situation happened there. Green was in front of a three-judge panel. They brought him in for sentencing. They asked him whether, they talked about the non-capital counts. They asked him whether he had anything to say. He said no. And then they proceeded to sentence on the non-capital counts and on the capital counts. This court found that that was too ambiguous because the court specifically needed to ask him whether he had anything to say on his aggravated murder counts. And even though in Green, they asked him whether he had anything to say on his non-capital counts, this court found that that was not sufficient, that it has to be an unambiguous request.
But counsel, I guess I'm looking at the transcript right now, and Judge Powers says, does Mr. Osi wish to say anything? And Mr. Osi himself said, no, Your Honor.
Yeah.
So I guess you're answering Justice Lansinger and saying, you want us to have them do that again?
Yes. We would ask that this court require the trial court to ask, do you have anything to say on your aggravated murder counts, and make certain that he has the right to speak on his aggravated murder counts. And that's what this court's case law requires. Is not just that he be asked to speak on his non-capital case, that he knows he has an opportunity to speak on his non-capital and capital counts. And once again, going back to that second sentencing hearing, that was on post-control release error. That could not be on aggravated murder count. So asking him, I can concede that they provided right of allocution on non-capital counts. But that's not sufficient. He needed to be provided right of allocution on his capital accounts.
Is there not an obligation at some point, particularly when he's brought back for a second sentencing hearing, he is sitting there next to a competent lawyer?
Pardon?
He's sitting next to a competent lawyer. He has not been afforded the right to allocution. Wouldn't that be a time for somebody to say, Judge, there's something missing here?
Yes, and we have raised that counsel was ineffective for not doing that. But ultimately, this is a trial court's obligation. This court issued the decisions in Green and Campbell 13 years ago. It's a simple 2-point part requirement. Ask counsel whether they have anything to say. Ask the defendant whether they have anything to say.
Did your office represent him at the time of this initial sentencing?
No, we did not.
Do you know whether or not counsel were death penalty qualified at that point?
They were Rule 20
they
certified,
were.
Yes.
Is there any question of invited error?
No, I believe because when you look at this, and once again going to this is mandatory language directed towards the trial court.
Well,
and
of course, but someone who has been certified as an expert to handle a death penalty case would surely understand the provisions of what the criminal rules provide at the time of sentencing. And in the drama, if the court is prepared to impose sentence, wouldn't counsel have an obligation to speak up and say, Your Honor, there's something missing here?
Well, I believe that counsel should. I believe they were ineffective for not doing so, but that's
should
not...
there be a sanction imposed for counsel being so ineffective in a case like this?
I believe we've raised lots of issues of ineffective assistance of counsel in regards to defense counsel's representation of OC. I believe this is one major error, but I believe they committed a number of errors in not properly representing OC. I don't know if I can answer the question of whether that should lead to sanctions on their behalf, though.
Okay. Should we look at the certification of those counsel?
Oh, I believe this court should be looking at the certification. Obviously, you know, I come from the Ohio Public Defender's Office. I'm the head of the Death Penalty Division, and
you're the head of what?
The Death Penalty Division. We review almost all of the capital cases here in Ohio, and I would certainly invite this court to start looking at some of the attorneys who have been certified to represent death penalty defendants. Some of the representation is certainly we consistently raise that they're below the standards that should be provided.
Consistently raising issues of ineffective assistance,
yes,
despite the fact that these lawyers have been certified by Rule 20.
Right. Yes.
Thank you.
As I argued before, the failure here to not provide Mr. O.C. the right of allocution was not harmless. The trial court did not have anything to consider from O.C. on his behalf, and it was not clear to him that he could provide a statement on his behalf on his capital counts. The only thing that might have been clear is that he could have made an unsworn statement in mitigation, but once again, that is different from the right to have allocution during the sentencing hearing.
He's entitled to both, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, and had he done the unsworn statement, you still would be here under these circumstances?
I believe so. I think that we would then have a question of whether it's harmless, because then you might have something to, the trial court might have had something to consider on his behalf, but we would still be, there would still be error. It would just be a matter of whether an unsworn would have rendered it harmless. Mm-hmm. The trial court failed to adhere to the requirements of Criminal Rule 32. We ask this court to remand the case for resentencing, at which time OC is provided with his right of allocution. If this court doesn't have any further questions, we will answer any other questions during rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, Michael Oster on behalf of the state of Ohio. Your Honors, in addressing the issue that has been raised here by the appellant, that of allocution, the state has a number of responses. First, I think the entirety of the record must be evaluated in this case. The entirety of the record to include both the April 29th hearing as well as the May 10th hearing in this matter. The April 29th hearing and what occurred that's important at the transcript on the April 29th hearing was after all the mitigation evidence had been put into the record, and the stage they were at is we were only waiting to do closing arguments in the case. At that point, Judge Powers asked whether there was anything that the defendant wished to say in allocution. He received a negative response. He then asked,
he used the word allocution.
Yes, ma'am. He used the word allocution on page 144, and this is on page 144 to 145, the following passage, Your Honor. And he got a negative response. He then asked, well, does he understand that he can make an unsworn statement here today? Yes, he does. The judge then asks, and he understands that if he makes that unsworn statement, will not be subject to cross-examination. Yes, he does. Judge says, all right, you've explained all this to them. Counsel says, yes. Judge then looks at the defendant himself and he says, do you understand that, Mr. Osi? Mr. Osi says, yes. The judge says, all right, very well then, thank you very much. Later on at the May 10th.
Well, shouldn't he have asked one more question? He asked him if he understood it. Shouldn't he have said, understanding all of that, do you want to make an unsworn statement or a statement in allocution?
The statement The first question, and I'll quote the transcript from Judge Powers. Very well. All right, Mr. Howard, does Mr. Osi have anything he'd like to say by way of allocution? Mr. Howard, lead defense counsel. No, Your Honor. So the judge already knew that there was no statement that Mr. Osi wanted to make an allocution. And then the judge followed that up by not only addressing counsel, but then addressing Mr. Osi at the end and saying, do you understand all of this? And got a response from Mr. Osi of, yes, I understood. The judge then said, very well, thank you. The only thing left to do, again, at that point, were closing arguments. All of the mitigation evidence had been received. The judges were fully aware of all of Mr. Osi's mitigation. They specifically used not only the term allocution, but then made a separate line of questioning as to the unsworn statement and the fact that that was not subject to cross-examination.
Was that premature for an allocution at that point?
I would argue that it's not. Although I understand this court's decision in State v. Green, and while I disagree, and we'll get into some of the facts of Green a little bit, when you look at the procedures that a three-judge panel has to accomplish in a sentencing phase of a capital murder case, at the time they retire, the statute says that they, if they decide that the aggravating circumstances outweigh beyond a reasonable doubt the mitigating factors, it says they shall impose the sentence of death. And so the state's position is, at this time is when the three-judge panel needs to hear all allocution, all mitigation, all unsworn statements, because once they've gone back to deliberate, and the statute says that they shall then impose death, what is the unsworn statement, or what is a second statement at that point going to do? Their deliberations are done. It's final. They shall impose the death sentence.
But counsel, if we can go back a step, how would you respond to the appellant's argument that wasn't the purpose of the hearing? At that point, it was only the purpose of that rehearing was only about sentencing because there hadn't been the post-release control statements being made. That couldn't have related to the death penalty, to the death sentence. It could only have related to the other sentences.
Okay, now, and I want to make sure we're on the same page, Justice French, you're talking about the May 10th hearing.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah, I'm sorry.
Everything previously I discussed is at the April 29th.
Okay.
At that May 10th hearing, I disagree the reason why all parties came back. The reason why the parties came back is the three-judge panel and all parties believed that the sentence was void. The parties came back because they believed they had to do a completely new sentencing. And I think that's evinced by the fact that the trial panel here doesn't simply say, well, Mr. Osi, here's your post-release control. They go through and read in the record the entirety of the weighing process, the entirety of the balancing, because they believe they have to do a completely new sentence to reimpose the entirety of it. All parties were under that understanding as well. That is what was going to happen on that
and
May 10th.
How do you know that? When you make the representation that all parties knew that everything was back on the table, where do we find support for that in the record?
I believe in the record on that May 10th hearing, it's on pages, I believe it's 3 through 4, where Judge Powers is discussing this. And he talks about, we were here a week ago and we conducted a hearing. At that time, we failed to advise him of post-release control. The court there believes that the sentence or a portion thereof was void and the defendant must be resentenced.
Would you say that again? Slow down. The court believes what?
It says, the court in this matter, the court believes that the sentence or a portion thereof was void and that the defendant must be resentenced to correct that error, the same to include an advice on the application of post-release control to this matter. It doesn't say the same to be exclusive of. It's to include.
But he did say that the sentence is void or a portion thereof. Doesn't that leave open the possibility that the hearing was only for the purpose of that issue?
I believe that's simply just a slight misstatement on the judge's part. I don't believe that changed everyone's understanding who was there in the room. I was one of the attorneys there in the room, and so I can't go into all that. But when he says the same to include, not to be exclusive, just post-release control, I think that evinces what the attorneys in the room, what Mr. Osi, what the three-judge panel understood. And I think that is bore out not just by the fact that it says the phrase include, but by the entirety of that hearing. I think the totality of everything that was said in that hearing bears out that all parties believed it had to be a complete new resentencing hearing.
And when it was done in May, the cases that came out from this court were suggesting that a resentencing had to be done from the get-go. The entire sentencing had to be done. It wasn't until later that there was another opinion that talked about a portion of the case being redone, correct?
That's correct, Justice. So we were all under that application of the law at that time. And after the judge says that, you know, Criminal Rule 32A says you should address the counsel and you should address the defendant. So he ends his phrase with, before I do so, does counsel wish to put anything on the record? Mr. Howard, no, Your Honor. Mr. Washington, no. Judge Powers again, does Mr. Osi wish to say anything? Defendant, no, Your Honor. So at that May 10th hearing, both counsel are addressed and Mr. Osi is addressed as to whether they wish to say anything before the imposition of sentence in this case. And I think it's also telling that on page 7 of that hearing, Judge Powers says that Mr. Osi, quote, exercised his right to remain silent, specifically waived his right to any elocution. I think that also demonstrates the panel's understanding of what had happened in this case, that when you couple that April 29th and that May 10th hearing, that the panel and the parties believed that Mr. Osi had waived elocution specifically and had also waived the right to give an unsworn statement.
What was the sentence imposed at the May 10th hearing?
I'm sorry?
What sentence did the court impose at the May 10th hearing?
It was the same hearing that was imposed previously in the May 3rd. It just included a post-release control.
Was there a separate sentencing order for the May 10th hearing?
I don't believe we had ever put on a judgment entry of conviction based on the May 3rd, because as soon as we realized, I think on May 4th, that there was that error, and so no one had put on the actual entry, and the judges hadn't yet done their final sentencing opinion.
So there's only one sentencing order, sentencing opinion in this case.
I believe that's correct, Justice.
Imposing the death penalty, and it was subsequent to the May 10th hearing.
Correct.
Thank you.
And I think it's important to...
Counsel, I want to make sure I understand that.
Yes.
Are you suggesting that the May 10th hearing was a totally new sentencing hearing?
Yes, I am.
Because the judge said that the earlier hearing was void, or the sentence was void.
Correct.
And are you responding to Justice O'Donnell from the May 10th hearing, there was no new sentence?
The sentence imposed, death and the number of years, were all the same as what was given on May 3rd. The panel didn't change their opinion on those. What I'm saying is there was never a memorialized judgment entry of conviction or sentencing, formalized written sentencing opinion that was written in between May 3rd and May 10th. It came after May 10th.
Okay.
I think importantly as well, a couple other parts of the transcript on that May 10th hearing I would point out. On page 17, after it's all concluded, the judge again looks at the defendant and asks the defendant, do you understand all these rights? The defendant again says yes. He gets another personal response from the defendant in this case after the entirety of the sentence is concluded. And I think that's important to note as well, because as we've discussed here, that this sentence was a completely new sentence. This was all done now. They had regone through all the weighing factors, all the weighing process, and they again addressed the defendant and asked him if he understood all of this, and again got a personal response from this defendant here in this case.
And can you tell us how this differs from the Green case that opposing counsel is referring to?
Yes, Justice. I think Green, importantly, as I read Green, and specifically on page 359 of the Green decision, this court authored that the trial court clearly erred in not explicitly asking Green in an inquiry directed only to him whether he had anything to say before he was sentenced. I believe in Green, the real error was the fact that Mr. Green was never explicitly asked himself whether anything had happened. Just previous in the decision, when this court quotes what happened in the lower court in that case, the lower court there said, and I'll quote, is there anything with regards to those offenses, counsel or Mr. Green, prior to the court passing sentence on both those counts as well as counts 7, 8, and 10? The defense counsel spoke, but never did the court revisit and ask Mr. Green or get any form of any answer from Mr. Green in that case. And so I think there's a big divergence between that case and this case, where both at April 29 and on May 10, the trial court here, the panel, did address Mr. Osi, did affirmatively hear from Mr. Osi. And on May 10th, it wasn't just that one time. It was also again at the very end of that hearing that we get that address from Mr. Osi. So the state's position here is that Green is satisfied, 32A is satisfied. The panel did comply with allocution in this case. Counsel was not ineffective here because their client was specifically addressed. And what we know from the April 29th hearing is that they had discussed these rights with Mr. Ossie. Mr. Ossie affirmatively stated that on the record, that he understood all of these rights. And so we believe that Green is satisfied. But if this court were to find any difference, we would find that this would be a harmless error type case. It's clear from the record that Mr. Ossie never intended to say anything in his behalf, whether it be under allocution, whether it be under an unsworn statement. Mr. Ossie never intended to make any of those statements here. The other things that we've argued under this about reconsideration of Green and those things, they haven't really been addressed here today, so I won't go through them. I think we fully briefed those issues out, and they're there for the court to consider as well. I still have a 17 minutes sitting on the clock. The appellant has only addressed one issue.
Counsel, really, I wonder if you could turn to the merger.
I would be more than happy to. Under the merger proposition, the appellant argues that the aggravated burglary specification, the A7 specification and the A8, which is the killing of a victim witness specification, should have been merged. Where that argument falters is in the animus part of the Johnson test, which is the second part of the Johnson test. And what's important is the panel here found that Mr. Ossie went to David Williams' home to try to persuade him not to file charges against Robin Patterson. The panel found that he went to try to persuade him by using menacing, assault, to try to persuade him not to file those charges. The panel noted that it was only when these measures failed that Mr. Ossie had to come up with a new purpose. And that's what an animus is. So he initially went to the home with a purpose to persuade. When his purpose to persuade failed, Mr. Ossie then had to switch into a purpose to eliminate and a purpose to kill Mr. Williams. And that's where, under the Johnson test, these two things, the A7 and the A8 specifications, differ and did not need to be merged because they were committed with a different animus. The aggravated murder was so unnecessary to the aggravated burglary in this case, he wanted to persuade. Well, when that didn't work, he had to come up with a new mindset. And so that switch in mind of persuasion to purposeful killing of that victim witness demonstrates that the animus in this case, and this court has defined animus as the purpose or immediate motive. So his purpose or immediate motive now had to switch. And so based upon those things, there was no need for merger. What I would say is the appellant cites the case of State v. Fry. Well, in State v. Fry, the defendant in that case went over to someone's house to kill them. They went over to eliminate them with that purpose in mind. If the trial court here had found Mr. Ossie guilty under count one, which was the premeditated murder, that he had gone there with prior calculation and design to kill David Williams, the merger question would be different. But the trial court here found beyond a reasonable doubt that we didn't satisfy prior calculation design because they believe the evidence bore out that he initially went there only to persuade, only to menace, only to assault. And so based upon that, it not only makes a differentiation from Fry, but it makes a differentiation in his animus that he had to change courses during the process of those actions on that fateful night, February 14th. And that is why the merger in this case did not need to occur, is because the second prong of the Johnson test was not satisfied. Again, I'll be more than happy to go through any other issues before this court. I would rather address issues this court has and specific questions that this court has rather than just randomly picking and choosing.
Did you want to comment on the fact that we have cases that talk about eliminating a witness and the proceedings that are necessary to be in effect before we actually have that concept? I know your brief talks about the distinguishing factor, but if you'd like to elaborate on that, please.
I'd be more than happy to. The main case is State v. Conway. In State v. Conway, this court looked at that A8 specification And specifically on paragraph 55, this court said that that A8 specification does not require that a criminal action be pending when the defendant kills the victim witness. This court even went on to say, we've previously held that, and it cited the Keene case, the Brooks case, the Hooks case, and the Yarborough case to all say that this court has interpreted that A8 specification that no pending criminal action need already be occurring for that. The appellant cites the case of State v. Malone to say that this court should alter its interpretation. The problem with the Malone case is it interpreted a completely different statute. The Malone case did not interpret this A8 specification. The Malone case interpreted the intimidation statute, intimidation of an attorney, victim, witness. And what's important in Malone that this court acknowledged, I think, are three things. The first is that the Malone case understood that that statute, the intimidation statute, included the word attorney. And this court noted that including the word attorney means that some action, some formal proceeding has already occurred for an attorney to be involved. The second thing this court noted is the term action was used in the Malone case. And this court defined action, and this court found that it includes the formal proceedings in a court of justice. Well, both the words attorneys and action are lacking in the A8 specification. They're not under that specification. I think importantly, too, under the A8 specification, it uses the phrase in any criminal proceeding. Well, that contemplates in any, a future event that could occur. Whereas under the 2921.04b, which was the intimidation statute, it used the phrase involved in a criminal action or proceeding. Much different wordings that intimates that someone is already, present tense, involved in an action or proceeding. And so the state's position would be that Conway, Brooks, Hooks, Yarborough, Keene should all be followed, that Malone is a different statute that used terms action, attorney, and a present tense phraseology, and does not need to be followed. I'd also note that the legislature has amended that version of the intimidation statute to now make it where the Malone issue has been resolved so that someone could be protected under those that type of situation. So we're also looking at a statute and wording that after Malone was subsequently changed in 2012. So our opinion would be to keep following this court's precedent because nothing has changed since Conway was decided. Well, before I keep going and say something I don't want to that gets me in a hole, I will end. I will thank this court for its time. I'll respectfully request that this court affirm both the conviction of Mr. Osi and the sentence imposed on him. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel?
I just wanted to address a few things and see if the court had any additional questions. Going back to address, I think, one of the justices' questions on the second hearing. The second hearing that took place on the post-control release issue occurred on May 10th of 2010. If you look at this court's decision in Singleton, that came out, I believe, in December of 2009, this court made it clear that when there is a post-control release error that needs to be corrected, there is not to be a de novo hearing, that it should be just a new, a hearing just to correct the post-control release.
But how do you explain then the Judge Powell's statements and the fact that the sentencing opinion was not done until after the May 10th resentencing? There was not an opinion that emanated from the May 3rd.
I don't know if I can explain it other than to say that maybe there was not an understanding that because there had been a change in the law just probably a couple months before.
Even if you didn't understand Singleton, and I think maybe by the language that was quoted by opposing counsel, that's clear. Even if we said in Singleton it was not necessary and you only zero in on the post-release control flaw, and the three judges proceeded, even though Singleton was decided, to conduct an entire resentencing on May 10th, appropriate or not, they did it. So what's your response to that?
Well, I think they did do it, and probably, like you said, maybe not understanding that this was not to be a entirely new hearing.
But you agree it was a new sentencing hearing from the death penalty imposition to post-release control. And that is the sentence that was appealed from the May 10th sentencing hearing, an opinion that emanated from that.
Well, yeah, the judgment conviction and the sentencing opinion seem to refer to the May 10th hearing as what they are relying, what the entry relates back to.
Yes.
I think that was incorrect, because they shouldn't have been having a new hearing at that time. The first sentence was the death sentence that was imposed on him in May 3rd.
But the question here is not necessarily the propriety of a May 10th full-blown resentencing hearing. It's at that resentencing hearing, was your client afforded the opportunity that Criminal Rule 32A demands?
And I believe the answer to that is no.
Okay, tell me why not.
He was provided an opportunity to speak, but again, the court said that they were back on a post-control release error, and that part of the sentence was void.
But that's not exactly the language that was quoted here, and so when your client was asked, does he have anything to say, or was it wasn't limited to post-release control issue?
The court just asked whether he had anything to say, but it came on the heels of the court statement that they were here to correct the post-control release error. So there would be no indication to
When the judge said we're here because the sentence or a portion thereof is void, you think that was noticed to your client, you can only speak on post-release control?
I think that it was probably at the very best ambiguous, and I think that that's not sufficient to comply with Rule 32. This is the trial court's obligation to make it clear, and it's a simple requirement. It's not asking the trial court to do anything except for to make clear that he has the right to speak on his non-capital counts, and he has the right to speak on his capital counts.
Let's say that we're back at the April 29th. Is that what you're saying, that the judge would have had to ask your client, do you have anything to say either on your capital offenses or your non-capital offenses?
Yes, I believe that is what the rule requires.
And the judge has to say that specifically, because I didn't hear that in the response to Justice Lanzinger's question to you, that there had to be a specific reference from the judge to the defendant. Do you have anything to say both on your capital and your non-capital offenses?
Well, if I admitted that there was to be, it was to be made clear that the client is supposed to be able to speak on both the non-capital and capital, then I erred there.
Supposed to be able to, but there's no distinction. My question is, are you saying the judge, any judge, has to ask at the point of allocution, do you have anything to say on either your capital or your non-capital offenses, if there are not non-capital offenses related to the capital?
I believe that would be the best practice, to make it clear to the client that he has a right to allocute on both the non-capital and capital. I guess that there would be circumstances where the court is talking about all the counts to the client and then says, do you have anything to say about these counts? And that might be sufficient. Probably the best practice, though, would be to make clear that he has a right to speak on both the non-capital and capital counts.
And the allocution refers to a right on non-capital offenses.
Yeah.
Could you address for me, please, the argument that Mr. Oster raises, that the opportunity for allocution was afforded prior to argument? He argues to us that that is the appropriate time, because subsequent to that, if the three-judge panel deliberates and determines that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors, then it shall impose the penalty of death, and it would be too late for an allocution because that penalty had been determined. So would it be appropriate prior to argument or subsequent to argument and prior to deliberation or subsequent to the deliberation and prior to the imposition of sentence? What is your experience or what is your thought about that?
I think the rule simply requires that it occurred during the sentencing, and I understand Mr. Oster's argument that...
Is this confused around the state?
No, it's not.
When do the trial judges in this circumstance, when do the three-judge panels offer this opportunity of allocution?
At the time of sentencing, because that is what the rule requires.
Subsequent to the deliberation of the three-judge panel, or...
Yes.
Prior to the time they deliberate.
Yeah, I have never seen a defendant in any of my reviews of transcripts, and I've read a lot of three-judge panel transcripts. I've never seen a defendant asked about the right of allocution during the middle of a mitigation hearing that was asked here. I've never seen that.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is when do the three-judge panels normally offer the opportunity of allocution to an accused?
At the time of the sentencing hearing.
So prior to the imposition of the sentence and subsequent to their deliberation?
Yes.
So they've already determined, for example, that
right.
The aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors, and therefore whatever that mitigation or allocution statement is can't really be considered because the penalty has been determined.
Well, I think it is required. I mean, if you look at this court's decision just from October in Roberts, it's required to be considered. So I don't know how you resolve that conflict, but I think it's required to be considered. And
so should the offer of allocution be made prior to their deliberation?
Not unless the rule is changed. I think
Counsel 32A is related to any case, any criminal case.
Right.
And it says that the person is to be addressed personally and asked if they wish to make a statement in his or her behalf or present any information in mitigation of punishment. So the whole point here is to see if the defendant wants to say anything in mitigation of punishment. In capital cases, we have an entirely different system. We have statutes that are very specific. And the statutes that talk about mitigation and the weighing process that a three-judge panel has to make talk about the need to consider mitigation. Don't you want your client to have that opportunity to place statements in mitigation before the panel deliberates?
Yes, and that's what 29-2903, I think D1, provides for the client to make an unsworn statement. So that would be where, before, during the mitigation phase, where a client would have an opportunity to present mitigation is through an unsworn statement, which is also allowed in capital offenses. And once again, going back to State versus Campbell and State versus Green, those were both death penalty cases. And this court determined that all of the requirements of Criminal Rule 32.1 should painstakingly be adhered to. That did not occur in this case. And we would ask this court to remand for resentencing that would be consistent with and would comply with Criminal Rule 32. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decisions. Thank you very much.